Do our surroundings, the environments that we craft, mold, and build to create our homes and public spaces, have the power to heal us? The interconnection between our senses, emotions, immune system, and a place in nature are complicated and strong. The health of our environment is directly linked to our personal health and well-being. Stay with me to hear about one amazing human being who has changed the quality of life for literally millions of human beings because she gets all that and because people are listening. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Innovation. And I'm going to share quite a bit about our guest because we're going to be spending the next hour with her. And I want people to have a sense of who she is and what she's doing because the platform that she is using matters so much. But before that, I want to thank the sponsor of this show because Mike Franks deserves a shout out. He pointed out that we weren't really talking about the sense of place, the built environment. And he encouraged us to put more focus on the built environment. And he's actually responsible for having our guest today because I remembered hearing our guest speak. I thought it was about 2 or 3 years ago. It was actually in 2013. So time flies. So Mike Franks from Seaver Franks Architects, thank you because you have helped elevate this conversation and we appreciate it and you. So now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Esther Sternberg. She is a professor of medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson, research director of the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, and director of the U Arizona Institute on Place, Well-Being, and Performance. She's a best-selling author, a dynamic speaker, recognized by her peers as a spokesperson for the field because of her ability to translate complex scientific subjects and make it into a highly accessible manner. And as you know, my listeners that have been with me, that is so important. She does not get lost in translation. So with a combination of academic credibility, passion for science, and compassion as a physician, Dr. Sternberg takes all that and lectures nationally and internationally to both lay the groundwork and to provide scientific information to her audiences. She's frequently interviewed on radio, television, and film, and on print media on subjects. And I have had the privilege of hearing you speak, so a warm welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And it did feel like yesterday.
Yeah,
I remembered it was like one of those times that's a touchstone for awakening of things that you might sense and know, and then you bring it into focus and say, oh, that's why that was a good experience, or, oh, that's why it was a bad experience. So the timing is perfect for you to be here since my husband was in the hospital 7 times last year.
Oh, dear.
And it was
so
TMC,
sorry.
And they have a sense of place.
They
have that,
they
and
do.
I sought out those places. So I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the difference you've made and all the lives you touched. So your work and your impact on the quality of life for so many. I would love you to tell us how that journey began.
Wow. How did that journey begin? Well, first of all, I'm trained as a rheumatologist. I'm a physician. And I was going to go, I had been in family practice for a couple of years, and I was going to go back into my family practice when I finished my rheumatology training. But at the very end of that training period, I was called to see a single patient. It was Christmas Eve back in 1978, and the patient had received an experimental drug for a very rare and fatal form of epilepsy that changed his brain serotonin. And the reason I was called as an emergency consult at 4 o'clock on Christmas Eve was because the patient had developed this horrible autoimmune scarring inflammatory disease. And as a rheumatologist, that was one of my areas of expertise. And the question the surgeons asked me was, is this drug that we're giving him that's helping his epilepsy, is that causing this horrible autoimmune scarring disease? And I realized at that moment that I did not know the answer. And the only way to figure that out, the question of doing something to the brain, could that cause an immune disease? So that brain-immune connection. Back in 1978, 79, the medical community did not believe that the brain and the immune system talked to each other. So I realized I had to go into a research career in order to figure out the answer to that question. So that really led me into the science of the mind-body connection. So fast forward to when I was at the National Institutes of Health as a research scientist several years later, I discovered that the part of the brain that controls the stress response, the hypothalamus, is important in susceptibility to autoimmune inflammatory diseases like arthritis. And I discovered that in rats. So it was very hard for the scientific community and the medical community to say, oh, it's all in your head. The rats should see a therapist. Because
that was really, not happening.
No, well, because it really was in their head. It was in the brain. And so I and a relatively small group of scientists at that time, that was back in 1989, had shown the many ways in which the brain and the immune system talk to each other. And had my work proved that if you break that communication, you get disease. If you maintain that communication, you get health. And so fundamentally, that's the basis of the mind-body connection, the science of the mind-body connection. And it explains how stress can make you sick, how believing can make you well, all these things that previously were not believed by the scientific community because there was no proof. So how do I get from that rheumatologist, mind-body connection, brain-immune connection to the impact of the built environment on health? I wrote a book published in 2000 to address this brain-immune mind-body connection. It was called The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. And I wrote it in a way that I wanted people to feel that they were right there holding the hand of the scientists who had discovered and proved what had been known for thousands of years, but we didn't see it in Western medicine. So I wanted them to feel they were there. And without realizing it, what I did is I set the stage, I described the characters, I described the action. It was like writing a play. And the end result of that was when I was writing the book, I described all of the scientists whom I knew personally and where they worked. And then I went back to all of those places to be sure that I got the description of the space right. And the effect of that was that architects read that book. And many architects asked me, are you an architect? Because the details were so accurate. And I said, no, I'm not an architect. But it made me realize that there was more to the brain-immune-mind-body connection than just what's going on within your body or between you and the next person. That place is important. At that time, a number of architects read the book and alerted a colleague at the U.S. General Services Administration, Kevin Campshire, who was then research director for the U.S. General Services Administration. That is the agency of the federal government that builds and operates all non-military federal buildings, housing over 1 million office workers, over 370 million square feet of office space. And Kevin came to me I was at his sister agency, the National Institutes of Health, and he asked if I could help him to measure the impact of all of that office space on the health, well-being, and performance of those office workers within those spaces.
So that was a big day.
And that was a big day. We actually were sitting at a bar when he asked me.
You're like, what?
We were at a conference in San Diego, and we had gone, a group of us with architects and neuroscientists had gone out afterwards. And that's when Kevin asked me the question. And we started what has become a 20-year collaboration using wearable devices to measure various aspects of health, well-being, and performance, the stress response, heart rate variability, which is an indicator of the stress and relaxation response, physical activity. We've moved on to using very sophisticated devices that can measure sleep quality as well. Now, the world of wearable devices for health is just exploding. There are so many on the market, and every day there's a new wearable device that measures more and more. And so we were able to link the various aspects of the built environment to various aspects of health. So the first study that we did together was back, we published it in 2010. It was in a federal building which was being retrofitted. And the old office spaces were these dark, dank, high-wall cubicles, no views, little light, poor airflow, high mechanical noise. And the same building was retrofitted to have beautiful, light and airy spaces, views to the outside, good airflow, lower mechanical noise. And I have to tell you that when we did this study, and this was back in the early 2000s, the level, the quality of wearable devices was nothing like it is today, and they were big and clunky.
It's like the first cell phone compared to what we have
exactly.
Now that fits in your pocket.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
The evolution of that.
Right. It was a big clunky thing with wires, and people had to wear this for 3 days. But people wanted to do it. People really want to know how their health is. And we found, much to my surprise, we also collected salivary cortisol. So we measured two different aspects of the stress response, the neuronal stress response and the hormonal stress response. And much to my surprise, we found that the people in the new space were significantly less stressed on those two different measures than people in the old space, or than they were themselves before they moved into the new space. Yet, when we asked them questions, did you feel stressed or not, they did not detect a difference subjectively. But the difference in the stress response, the lower stress response, carried through even to when they were asleep at night. So this was such a striking finding that we continued our work. After I moved to the University of Arizona, I created an institute on place, well-being, and performance, linking the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, the College of Medicine, and the College of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape Architecture. And now we have the College of Engineering, the College of Science, a number of colleges across the university to explore and use the most state-of-the-art devices and methods and data analytics to measure the impact of many different aspects of the built environment on many different aspects of health, well-being, and performance. I should add that there was one piece in this long journey that I left out. So somewhere around 2007 or so, after presenting some of this work, I was asked by the editor of Harvard University Press to write another book about what we were doing. And so we called it, I wrote the book, and it was called Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. And when I came out to look at the job in Tucson, when Andrew Weil and Victoria Mazes recruited me to come out here, I told them straight up that I wasn't moving to the desert, you know. I was a
that
big
is
city.
Not uncommon.
I was a big city East Coast girl. I grew up in Montreal. I knew snow. I did not think the desert was in my future. I got here and I was blown away. And I fell in love with the desert. And most importantly, I was so impressed with what the Center for Integrative Medicine was doing, training at that point, I think, about 1,000 fellows. And really, Andy Weil is a pioneer of integrative medicine, integrative health. And so the idea of being part of this really exciting frontier of integrative medicine, really instantiating into practice all of those scientific principles that I had discovered at the bench in terms of the science of the mind-body connection. And then the possibility to really take what I had written in my book, In Healing Spaces, and make a real entity, an institute that incorporates all of those elements of research, of practice, of curriculum and education, of policy into a real entity, that opportunity is what, you know, my mind was made up and I came out here.
And here you are. And we're glad you yeah. are, because talk about early adopters. I mean, it was going on when there were lots of words for it. They're kooks, they're crazy. The scientific yeah. community rejected, not all of it, but I was there. I was saying, you cannot, mind, body, spirit, it's one.
Right.
It's not silos. So I was interested from the get-go. So do go on.
Well, so to speak to that, of the pushback, that was what the question I asked in my first book was, where did Western medicine go wrong in ignoring what has been known for thousands of years? And why, you know, those of us in the field, I was part of a MacArthur Foundation network, mind-body network at the time, and there were only about 12 or 15 of us on the network from you know, top universities, Harvard, Stanford. You know, I was at the National Institutes of Health, University of Chicago. And we would come together about three times a year, and we all felt the same thing, that we were not ignored in our own institutions. It would have been good to be ignored. We were actually rejected. We were actively pushed back. There was pushback against. I had when I was in St. Louis, my supervisor told me, he showed me the palm of his hand, and he said, "You'll do this research on the brain-immune connection when grass grows here on the palm of your hand." Now, to give him credit, I think about 10 years later, he wrote me a very moving letter saying that, "Esther, you were right. His daughter had developed breast cancer." And he said, "All those things you said were correct. And I'm sorry, you know, you were right." So I think what I saw happening, and that's an example of it, that the naysayers who were steeped in the old dogma of medicine and science, saying there was not a connection between the brain and the immune system, they slowly began to accept this notion for a combination of reasons. First of all, there was overwhelming scientific, rigorous scientific evidence proving that the brain and the immune system talk to each other, that if you maintain those connections, you have health, and if you break them in many ways, you have illness. But also, the most powerful converts were those who had in their own personal lives experienced something that made it real. And that happened to me as well.
So when you talk about those things, you know, people that listen, myself included, sit there and think about the application to their lives. I mentioned what it was like to sit for hours in TMC wondering what the outcome would be. And I had gardens, and I had birds, and I had sunlight. I wasn't locked up in a little room. And so that's personal. I remember the first time I heard you speak, you told a story, and I am not the best with the exact facts. I remember the feelings. And you told a story about the research around healing or quality of life for the elderly. And at that point, I did not consider myself elderly, nor do I now. But it was remarkable. And you talked about designing buildings just so that from the room, people could see a tree. I remember that story. And that's how you told it. They could see a tree and what it meant versus a dark room with no access to any sign of nature.
Well, that's a very famous and classic study in this field, in environmental psychology. Roger Ulrich published that paper in 1984, way ahead of his time, where he looked at patients in hospital who were recovering from gallbladder surgery. He controlled for all sorts of things. They all had the same surgery. They had the same doctors, the same nurses. They were on the same ward, but some of them had a view of a grove of trees, and some of them had a view of a brick wall. And he looked at the health outcomes in those patients, and he found that the patients with a view of a grove of trees needed less pain medication, had fewer negative nurses' notes, so they were in a better mood, and they were discharged about a day sooner than the people who had a view of a brick wall. And, you know, that started this movement. It was published in Science magazine. So, you know, it had that level of credibility. And there were many studies that followed up on that subsequently. What we're doing now is taking that observational kind of work into the measurement domain. So
Got
we're
it.
Able to actually measure the range of temperature and humidity that is optimal for your stress response. We're able to measure the noise levels that are optimal for your stress response. We're able to measure how the layout of the office space, whether it's open seating, open bench seating, it's called, cubicles or private offices, how does that impact your stress response, your physical activity, your sleep quality? And we are doing it not only with surveys, but we are including surveys, sent questions sent to the smartphone and so on, but we're adding that extra layer of hard data that is now obtainable from these very sophisticated wearable devices. I'm wearing one right now on my finger.
This is when I wish we had video. We might have to take pictures of it.
It is a ring, and it tracks my heart rate variability, my physical activity, my sleep quality. So my stress response, my sleep quality, it's really remarkable. And there are many, you know, there's the wearable watches. There's all many of these. Many of the commercially available wearable devices have not been validated to the extent that they can be used in a research study. Some of them have, and more are being validated to that extent. But certainly most of them are really accurate for tracking steps, physical activity.
Right.
That's the most accurate. Regarding the stress response and sleep quality, there's a lot of variability. But whatever you're tracking, these things help you improve your health, help you become aware of the kinds of healthy activities that you need to engage in order to optimize your health.
And when you think about it, just I like to always put it into the layperson's term. If I exercise, I feel better. And I don't mean just physically better. I feel better. I'm in a better mood and I feel as though I sleep better. And if I exercise outside, that's like plus, plus, plus because I'm experiencing fresh air and we're cooped up in buildings for many, many hours. And I cannot let this show be over without mentioning the feelings that you get. And one perfect example I have on the U of A campus is the building, the Institute of the Environment. When you walk into that building, into that canyon, whatever's going on for me, and if I'm rushing or if I'm late to see somebody, I'm calmer. There's a sense of place that hits you in the face that it's calm here, it's cooler here, there's green here, there's vines here. So that's a scientific study because I'm just experiencing that as a human being. I don't stop and say, oh, I feel calmer here. Oh, this is a sense of place. It just happens.
So I think it's a very accurate observation that unless you're an architect or trained in the design professions,
right.
You don't realize, most people don't realize how much the physical environment impacts your health and well-being and therefore performance. You mentioned the Institute of the Environment building. So you may or may not know that we're building a new building for the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. We're in the planning stages of it at the moment. And our goal is to instantiate all of these principles into the design of that building. So the best buildings embody the mission and the vision of the organization that they're built for. And our mission and vision at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine is integrative health. How do you build a building? How do you design a building to embody all those aspects of integrative health? Well, it is completely possible, and we are doing that. That is our vision. So the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine has also is going to be launching an app for people to help people engage in these healthy lifestyle behaviors. So in the domains of nutrition, of healthy sleep, of resilience, so stress and relaxation response, balance, social interaction, spirituality, place, and physical exercise, movement. And so all of those aspects of integrative health are going to be embodied in this building. And in a very conscious way, we are going to have views to nature. We're going to have places for spiritual contemplation or meditation. We're going to have places to walk calmly, to exercise, places for social gathering, places, roof gardens, gardens throughout. Light and circadian light is very important. So that's full spectrum sunlight in the morning and lower light in the afternoon following the sun. That's very important for healthy sleep. So it is possible to create a building that does embody the all the different aspects of integrative health, and that's where we're going with this.
And it you know, as I, in my role in the beginning, I was so intimidated by the researchers, the scientists, the brain power, and then I realized that my role is to elicit the stories and to be the experience of the human being that validates what people who sit in my office or in my studio or that I interview can really make real, because I am that man or woman on the street that feels that sense of place. So I can't wait to come to the ribbon cutting ceremony and, you know, look at the people that you get to be with. I want to go back.
We'll invite you.
I hope so. I want you to mark that in your phone.
Okay.
I want to go back to, and we are by far and away not close to finishing, I hope that's okay. But in your TED talk, your TEDx talk, because I looked at a lot and I love to be really prepared and to remember and trying to jar those facts that I forgot. But I got the essence of that story that you told about the healing. You talked about your father being in a concentration camp that I had not heard of, and though I should walk in the valley of darkness, you went through that whole thing. I can't repeat it. So I wondered, in some way, did that lead you on the journey? Because that was what got him that sense of healing in place, and where he went to.
It's a really, really great question. And I continue to have insights into that. And may I read from it?
Yes,
from the book?
I would love that. Oh my goodness, I would love that.
So I'm going to read from, this is the last chapter of my book, Healing Spaces. It's called Healing Gardens and My Place of Peace. My father and I sat on the terrace outside the kitchen door, eating breakfast early on a spring morning. He had propped a book against his oversized coffee mug, an old white china cup with the word Dad inscribed on it. I didn't have to leave for school for at least an hour, and my mother and sister were still getting dressed. My father looked up at me from his book and smiled as I ate my cereal. "Listen. Listen to the sounds of peace," he said. I heard a dog barking, birds chirping, the pock-pock of a volley on the tennis court across the street. These sounds did not seem unusual to me. I heard them all the time. Not until many years later, after my father died, did I understand what they meant to him. He'd spoken those words in the mid-1950s, when the war in Europe was still only a decade behind him, still so fresh in his mind that he could appreciate such quiet moments and revel in a sense of peace. His favorite psalm was the 23rd. Sometimes after dinner, he would pull a Bible off the shelf and sit at the table and read it to my sister and me. Every once in a while, he would look up at us with a smile that contained both wisdom and calm. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters," He restoreth my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. My father had walked through the valley of the shadow of death during the war, somewhere in a concentration camp in a place called Transnistria. I found that out after he died. He had never talked about it. The reason I wrote this and the reason I tell the story when I speak is that I believe that when my father was in that place where he couldn't go outside, he didn't have the luxury of beautiful views or sunlight, he could find peace by going to this place in his mind by reading or thinking about or remembering the 23rd Psalm. And I've read this passage in many places. I went to Lourdes in the southwest of France. I describe it in the book, the miracle healing place in the southwest of France. I read it there. The Archbishop of Lyon stood up at the end of the conference. It was a conference between clergy and scientists and physicians trying to understand what is it about Lourdes that helps people heal. So the Archbishop of Lyon stood up and said, Esther, I don't know if you realize, but there wasn't a dry eye in the house when you read that, after you read that. It's a moving, it is a universally touching prayer. And it tells you that people need to be in a place of peace. As a result of that encounter, I was then invited by Pope Benedict's Minister of Health, Monsignor Zamowski, to speak at the Vatican at a conference for the healthcare workers in the 120,000 hospitals around the world that are run by the Catholic orders. And after that, Monsignor Zamowski, I did the same thing. I read this passage, and again, it had the same effect. And you see all these cardinals and so on, and people, it really, that poem, that prayer speaks to everyone, doesn't matter what your faith
right.
is.
At the deepest level, because it deepest. Got me, and you sat here reading it, and then there's not a dry eye in the studio either.
Well, Monsignor Zamowski told me after that reading, he said, tomorrow after the Mass, stick with me. And the result was he introduced me to the Pope, to Pope Benedict, which was the most spiritual experience I've ever had. And I'm Jewish, so it was...
So that's big. And I watched the movie, The Two Popes. Did you watch?
So
it was
did I.
It was unbelievably great.
Yes, it was. But so you asked me, did that experience of my father influence me? I'm sure it did. I don't think my parents, well, maybe they did explicitly convey to my sister and me that we were not put on this earth to just fritter away our time. We have a responsibility to do what we can to make this world better. And that's been my mantra the whole of my life. But I was thinking about this. You asked whether that experience of my father, my parents, because my mother also came from Romania, although they got out of the in 1938, before the war, fortunately. But we would do things when my sister and I were kids. We'd be washing the dishes after dinner, and we lived at the base of Mount Royal in Montreal, and my father was a professor at the University of Montreal, which was up on the hill on the mountain. And if it looked like there was a beautiful sunset, we'd drop everything, drop the dishes, we'd all pile into the car, we'd drive up to the University of Montreal, and we'd watch the sunset. And you know, my parents explicitly instilled in us that we should live each day as if it is our last and appreciate things like the sunset. So I think that certainly impacted my view of place.
I get it. Like, I really get it. And I certainly can say that for me. When I'm at my stress maxed, which happens a lot these days. And I freely admit it. There's not a lot of good reporting going on in terms of climate adaptation, mitigation. There's so much bad news. There's also good news, and there's hope, and there's possibility, and there are positive changes. But the only thing that works for me is to get out in nature. And I come out of this office, and I'll say to my husband, I really have to get out of here. Like, I have to get in nature, go down to Madera Canyon or go to Sabino Canyon, someplace where it's quiet. So I want to ask you this question, and I hope it cracks you up, because I'm a Jersey girl, right? Grew up in Jersey. You grew up, you are used to cities. You lived in New York. I live here now. I've lived here for 44 years. I love how quiet it is outside at night here, how very, very quiet. When I go to New York City and spend the night, it never used to bother me. So do you adapt? Like, I can't stand the noise. Like, there's always garbage trucks, taxis honking their horns, noise. And I love New York City. It's one of my favorite places on the planet. So do you, did my heightened sensory perception go up because I'm used to the quiet? It's very hard for me to sleep in New York City. Very hard.
I have to say I love New York City. I mean, I grew
love
up in Montreal,
New York City.
But I know the East Coast of the United States. I know Boston. I know New York City. I spent summers in Vermont. But I have to say it doesn't bother me. Maybe it is your heightened sense.
It's my heightened, because I am noise. But let's get back to where are we now? Because you were starting on this path a very long time ago. Andrew Weil, very long time ago, to put a lot of these dots and start connecting them. In terms of especially the built environment and new innovation, is it reaching a tipping point? Are people really getting the message now? Because Mike Franks convinced me that there are sick buildings and that it means there are sick people in them, that, and he is not a scientist. He is an architect.
So there's no question that this has become a movement across the design professions to make health front and center in building design. And the first thing is to get rid of toxins. Be sure there's no off-gassing, use, you know, natural materials.
Right.
Make sure there are no allergens. That's been around for a long time. That's been around in environmental science, in epidemiology, public health. What we're adding here is to create buildings that optimize and improve health and well-being. Well-being being the operative word. So to affect those emotions that are important in well-being, and so the question is, how do you do it? So that's why I do this research with the General Services Administration. It's like developing the prescription for the building. How do you design a building that will optimize health and well-being and performance? What is the range of temperature and humidity that's optimal? What is the range of sound, of noise that's optimal? What is the range of airflow and carbon dioxide, which you breathe out, and the
right.
carbon dioxide increases the longer you are in a closed space. The more people there are in the room for the longer period, the carbon dioxide increases, and that causes you to be fatigued, fall asleep, impairs your cognitive performance. So we're developing the at a very granular level the prescription for how to design and operate buildings for optimal health and well-being, including getting rid of the toxins. And so the light, circadian light, and the physical design of the office space and so on. And the great thing about this is that we have the technology now. We have the technology both in, as I mentioned, the wearable health, as well as the technology to measure many different aspects of the built environment continuously and in real time, either with wearable devices or mostly stationary devices. You can measure airflow, carbon dioxide, volatile organic compounds, light, sound, temperature, humidity, and so on. And beyond measuring all of this, as we discover what are these relationships and what are the optimal ranges, there are more and more technologies coming online to intervene to create these healthy spaces. So for every positive, there is a trade-off. So you want more light,
right?
Circadian light, you get heat, especially in the desert. So how do you do that? What if you're in a submarine? And you can't have light.
Right.
How do you get that circadian light to have optimal sleep? Airflow, it's expensive to, you know, increase the HVAC system. So how do you optimize the carbon dioxide, reduce that? We discovered a carbon dioxide bubble that each of us carries around, a bubble of carbon dioxide as we breathe out. And so how do you reduce that? Well, you can do it with a local fan. You have a local fan, there can be noise. It can dry the air out. Drying the air out causes you to get more viral infections. So for each of these interventions, there's a plus and a minus. And so that's where the science is going now, is to figure out how to optimally and individually, that's another thing that's really important. How do you create individual spaces that are optimal for that particular individual's needs, not only that particular individual's comfort range, which is different for different people, you know, temperature,
right.
Some people like
right.
it hotter, some people cooler, so on. But also for the task at hand, because you know, if you walk into a hotel or a spa, you want to be relaxed. If you're working in an FBI building, you want to be on target, you know.
Yes. And so vastly different.
So how do you design the space for the task at hand for the individuals? So the good news is that technologies are coming online, including in material science, to create these optimal individualized environments. They're not there yet, but we're working with architects at the College of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape Architecture. One of the architects is Alethea Ida, who is developing bioresponsive materials that will be embedded in chairs and walls to create your optimal temperature and humidity environment just in your little space. And that way, if that can be perfected, you don't need to turn up the HVAC so that everybody is freezing and so on. So we're working with the systems and industrial engineers at the University of Arizona, San Yang Jun, to develop automated responsive systems to automatically change the environment, your local environment, to optimize your health needs. So that's the exciting thing. There's data analytics, huge area in this is using complex data analytics. So Nirav Merchant, who's the head of the Data Science Institute at the University of Arizona, has the capacity for us to take this massive amounts of data we're collecting in our follow-on study. We have a study with Lockheed Martin and IARPA, which is the intelligence community's, the agency of the intelligence community that does this kind of cutting-edge research. So we have massive amounts of data measuring different aspects of health, well-being, and performance in office workers over a period of 2.5 months, and linking that to the different aspects of the environment. You can imagine over 2.5 months, how many heartbeats you have to figure out how that relates to everything else.
It's mind-boggling.
Massive 10.4 terabytes of data. It's huge. But the great thing, and this is why I came to the University of Arizona, we have it all here.
I know.
You know, it's amazing.
It's amazing. The brain trust that is in that. Yes,
right.
I agree.
We have the College of Science, Matthias Mell, a professor of psychology. We're working with him on these questions in, you know, the subject of questions and social interactions. And so it's really amazing to be able to put together this amazing team of cutting-edge scientists and experts and professors across the university to answer these very complex questions.
So this is not a very complex question, but it does come to mind. So will what you're doing, I know the applied research for buildings that are going to be built, are some of the things you're working on for the spaces that are already built that are not being retrofitted. And what where I'm coming from is a place where somebody might be listening to this and saying, what's in it for me? Because I sit in this cubicle in a government building. I don't see sunlight. Are there things for that person to do to help with their sense of well-being and their overall, you know, that combination of the beauty that you just described that will be optimal for employees or for staff or for people working in buildings? What for that person that's thinking, oh man, I don't have anything to look forward to when I go into my office. What can they do?
Well, one of the reasons we're working on these individualized solutions is that people will be able to do that.
In their own space.
Right. We don't have the answers yet, but that's something we're working on. We're creating what we're calling living labs across the university. So one of the wonderful things that President Robbins did when he came on board is he instigated this strategic planning, and I'm co-leading with Kathy Insull in the College of Nursing. She's the initiative owner of the aging, healthy aging, environments for healthy aging. And so we're working together on this. And what I've described doesn't only apply to office spaces. It applies to any spaces. You talked about TMC and the hospital spaces. I mentioned Roger Ulrich's study in hospital spaces. All of this applies also to creating healthy environments for aging, whether it's in aging communities. We're working with local developers on looking at different aspects of how this research can inform the healthiest design for these residential communities for aging. It can inform aging in place. It can inform, it could eventually inform classrooms and schools.
I was going to say how schools are built.
Certainly. I mean, once the getting the data from the office spaces is a way to get the data.
Right.
And we can take that information and apply it to all these different settings. I want to say one other thing. Actually, I want to say several other things.
So this is what I love. Take it away, Dr. Esther Sternberg. Go for it.
So living labs, I talked about as part of the strategic planning initiative, we're creating living labs. What is a living lab? It's simply taking any space. It can be just a small space like this studio. It could be your own little cubicle and wiring it up, measuring the impact of that particular space on various aspects of health, well-being, and performance of an individual or multiple individuals in those spaces. And so each of these living labs will be designed to measure different things. So for example, we're working with Sai Parthasarathy, the director of the Sleep and Circadian Center at the University of Arizona, also another leading sleep center, I think, in the country. And we're looking at the impacts of different aspects of the environment on sleep and sleep quality. And because we have that space where people are getting their EEG, their heart rate variability, their temperature, everything possible that is being measured anyway, we can add that element to those measures of the physical environment and the different aspects of the physical environment and ask the question, how do those aspects of the physical environment affect different aspects of sleep? So it's a very exciting time. It's a really exciting time at the University of Arizona. It's an exciting time at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. There's this opportunity to take all of these principles and implement them in a real building, in a new building that is being built. It's just terribly exciting. And I'm thrilled to be here.
And it can't happen soon enough. I mean, as my daughter said, she gave me this expression that I seem to be able to apply in many cases and it impacts my decision. It sparks joy. And we need to be talking about that more. Like, what are you doing? Because if you're happy, it creates, that happiness environment. So what other things did come up? I could see you cranking with, yeah. I want to mention this also. So take it away.
Well, you asked me about the things in my life that impacted my my interest in this area, in addition to the actual research with Kevin Kampscher and the GSA that really launched this. And I don't remember if I mentioned that Kevin is now director of high performance federal buildings for the GSA.
So you did not.
He is in the position where he can implement all this stuff. And he and his team are working with the standard setting organizations that set building standards to be sure that all of these principles, as we discover them, are there for anybody to use, anybody and everybody to use. But beyond that, I had, you know, my own personal experience, and there was certainly the mindset as I was growing up with my parents, but also there was an experience in my own personal life that that really brought home the importance of place in healing. And it was that when I was a long-distance caregiver for my mother who, when she was dying of breast cancer, and I went through a very stressful period at that time in my life, and I developed inflammatory arthritis, not rheumatoid arthritis, but similar, fewer joints were involved, and it was ironic because here I was a rheumatologist and arthritis specialist who had discovered that the brain stress response was important in inflammatory arthritis. And then 10 years later, I go and develop the whole thing. And I don't think it was a coincidence at all that I developed this arthritis at the time that I did. I clearly had the genes. You know, getting diseases like arthritis is a combination of genes and environmental exposures, and stress certainly contributed to having the illness show up when it did. I moved into a new house, which is another big stressor. And the day I moved into this house in downtown Washington, D.C., I got the call to fly up to Montreal for what turned out to be the last 3 weeks of my mother's life. And when I flew back to Washington after the funeral, I was sitting on my deck of my new house writing what was to become my first book, The Balance Within, and the doorbell rang, and it was my Greek neighbors, who Dean and Taria Papavasiliou, and they came bearing gifts, tzatziki, dolmades, you know, Greek food, to welcome me to the neighborhood, and they saw me writing on the computer, and they asked, "Are you a writer?" And I said, "No, I don't think I'm a writer. But I'm writing this book." And I said, "Why do you ask?" And they said, "Because we've always wanted a writer to stay at our cottage in Crete." So I said, "I'm a writer." And
lucky you. I remember reading about this.
Yeah.
Do tell.
So I went with them to Crete. And the funny thing is, I took my computer, but I thought I had the right converter, but whatever happened, I plugged it in and the thing blew. And so I wrote one paragraph and that was it. But it was a good thing because I was able to experience life in this tiny little village made of maybe 5 or 6 parallel streets parallel to the ocean, and a beautiful bay on a mountain sort of sloping into the ocean. And you couldn't drive in the village. You had to park at the edge of the village. And so I went from this sedentary life, you know, eating hamburgers and French fries for lunch. And I went to this walking every day, swimming in the Mediterranean, eating a healthy Mediterranean diet, being taken care of by all the grandmothers in the village. You know, I knew a little bit of Greek because the hospital where I trained in Montreal was in the midst of a Greek community. So I would show them my joints and I'd say panai, polyponai, which means pain, a lot of pain. And they'd showed me their joints and we'd all, you know, we were happy. And then I discovered, well, there was this wonderful old gentleman who had prostate cancer. And he was probably somewhere in his 80s, late 80s. And he lived at the bottom of the hill, and our little cottage was at the top of the hill. And every single morning, he'd come up the hill with his cane. He'd bring me an orange or a grapefruit picked from his tree. And he'd continue up the hill to a tiny little a Greek chapel with the icons and the candles. And And so one day I decided I felt well enough. I climbed up this path, and there's this tiny little chapel at the top of the hill, sitting on top of a ruins of a Byzantine church, which was on top of a Greek temple to the god Asclepius, the god of healing.
Talk about energies. And there was a lot going on there.
So I subsequently, after my book was published, I write about this in the book, and after my book was published, I did a PBS television special on this. The question was, what was it about that experience that helped me heal? And in that TV show, you can see that I say that I would sit for hours and contemplate. I'd listen to the birds and the sheep and the goats and look at the beautiful views and the bougainvillea on the white stucco homes and the blue ocean, and feel the breezes and smell the ocean air and the eucalyptus. But I didn't use the word meditate, and I didn't use the word pray. I didn't know I was meditating.
Right.
I was in the moment, but I was meditating. So I was doing all those mind-body activities that are so healthy. So number one, it was not a coincidence that I got sick when I got sick because of my lifestyle, because of the stress. And it was not a coincidence that I got better when I got better because I changed my lifestyle. I had that aha moment that if I continue the way I was when I was in Washington, D.C., I would only get sicker. And if I change my life the way I have in Greece, and I was only there for about 10 days, but it gave me that impetus to change. And I continued it in D.C. And, you know, you ask, how can people, do this in their own lives? Well, obviously, you can't have everybody going to Greece, but you can create your little tiny island of peace and calm. So in D.C., on my terrace, on my deck, I had potted plants I had gardenias and jasmine, so I could smell that fragrance on the night air that reminded me of the fragrance of the lemon trees and the orange trees in Greece. I had herbs that, you know, healthy herbs that you can use for cooking. I would be able to sit out there and find my place of peace. And everybody can do that for themselves.
For whatever it looks like for them. And I agree. And there are so many things. And it, to me, it's like, if whether it's a little apartment or a big house, especially in Tucson, where you can always get to a view of the mountains, and talk about the peace that comes over you, our sunsets. People go outside, and I always say to people, I stop for sunsets. I have pulled off the side of the road and gone and
do it.
And when I'm walking, I say, I stop for birds because I'll hear them. But that's so important, especially in this time of fast-paced, high technology, always being available, never-ending amount of emails. And, you know, I will never get an Apple Watch because anybody that I'm with. And I was with a friend of mine the other day, and I have a lot of friends that have them. As soon as it goes off and notifies them, the flow of whatever happens stops. And it's like, I don't want that. I have enough when I have to go to my computer and hear the like ping that I got another email. So I just wonder, as we kind of bring this to a close, and I'm really going to give some thought about the production of this show, because maybe we have an opportunity with our sound engineer and my input, to put it in segments that people can really press pause, because my last words will probably get me very emotional, but I want to kind of convey what happened to me as I was preparing for the show, because it really is all about you and the impact you have. So is there anything else that you would like to say to feel complete and like not get in the car and say, oh my gosh, I wish I had said that?
No, I do want to say something, but I have to read it on my phone, having said
I just want to press pause and say that's why I celebrate what our decision was to create our own studio, to learn how to do it, because I didn't want to live by anybody else's rules. I didn't want to be on NPR where I knew I had to ask 7 questions and they had to be this many minutes long. I love connecting with people and engaging in real conversations. And I love that I never know where that road is going to take us. It's not a predictable path. And that's kind of what I like about it. What is the unpredictable part of it? And I also want to like put you right on the spot and say, so you'll come back someday, right? And after there's more to report, because the people that are in my world listen and they care and they're evolving. And then my guests help us all continue on the journey and see the light and change our actions.
Well, I'm certainly happy to come back. This has been great fun. And really, I think one of the great things about writing books for the lay public, speaking to the lay public, doing interviews like this, is what's the point of doing this research if we can't get it out
right,
there for
right.
people
if there's
to
no
use?
Application for it. I agree.
Yeah, and it's the most rewarding thing.
And I will have gotten a copy of your book. It's something, I don't know if I've read the book, and it was way back when, but there are things that I knew that I didn't read about in the research that makes me think I'm going to go look on the bookshelf. It could have been how many years ago that I read the book, because it inspires me. A sense of place really matters to me. When you walked in the house, there's a lightness here. There's a brightness. There's a joy. And I feel that pretty much every time I walk into my house.
Well, I felt it when I walked in.
Yeah, you did.
Here,
and so. You mentioned it. It's like, why am I not surprised that you would say that? But it's a fun, whimsical house. Yeah. People like to be in this house.
Yeah.
And
no question
it does.
About it.
Yes.
No,
so did you find what you want to read?
I found what I want to read. So I do have an Instagram account. I'm just new to Instagram. But I find that when I see... I'm so visual. When I see pictures, I want to share them with people. When I see images that I want to share. So it's spring now here. For me, it's very surprising to have spring, even though I've been here eight years.
In the middle of March?
In the middle of winter. I mean, this is February, March. But so I saw these beautiful flowers coming up through some rocks, and then I noticed other flowers coming up. And so it reminded me of this psalm. Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. It's from the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon. I only realize now that that must have been another one of the psalms that my father read to us as children, because my association, my image in my mind when I read that is of the maple trees arching over the street with their early yellow, very light green blossoms and leaves in Montreal. And I must have been 5 or 6 years old when I thought to myself, how is it that turtles sing?
Oh, my
this
goodness.
This is why I know this is a memory.
Right.
But of course, it's turtle doves. But the desert is, this is the desert. The winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. And we're here in this amazing place that was described in the Bible how many thousands of years ago.
Right.
And we get to have that sense of peace. And I do think it was my father who transmitted it to me as well.
And we also talk about it. People here in the past week or two have been talking about the weather. I'm so happy I live here. This is why I put up with the summer. Things are blooming that might not be blooming. Maybe shouldn't be blooming because it's getting a little bit early. And it was funny today when I went out to lunch, I thought, okay, it's coming. I was looking to park my car in the shade because it was going to be, it was like 89
warm,
inside.
Yeah.
It's like it's starting to happen. So I love having the last word because I usually do. And it's like it's part of fun of having my own show. And sometimes I get emotional, and I'm really proud of that, because if the world showed their emotion more, I think we'd be in a lot better place. So my last words are about gratitude, and they're gratitude for you and gratitude for Mike Franks, who brought this all together and reminded me of what a sense of place is and why it matters so much and the built environment. And I think that most of us who are working in the world to make a difference, and whatever that looks like for what we do or what we did, we ask ourselves, did I make a difference? Did it land with people? How much of a difference did it make? And will people make some changes? I ask that. It's great to be inspired, but then impact is what I'm trying to do, is get people to change some of the things. So when I heard you speak, my level of awareness changed. And what I wanted to do as a tribute to your work is say, yes, you made a difference for me. I'm here sitting with you, facing you, being very grateful that I got to spend this time. But I noticed things that I hadn't before, and that matters. I noticed that I was in a healing place with TMC when I was really worried about the person I love most in the world. And you and Mike Franks brought that message back to me front and center, and we're pursuing more people to interview about the built environment and the sense of place. And all Mike had to do was say to me, Gina, think about how much time we spend inside and in buildings. And do you know that a lot of those buildings are sick? And kind of said, I can't believe you're not talking about that more, but he helped me know better so then I can do better. And we're going to do a series, more and more shows on the built environment. So I want to say thank you for being wonderful, impactful, you, and delivering your message with such clarity that everyone can understand, because for a lot of scientists, that is not the case. And you know that. It's a big complication that I help with. And then, of course, I always want to end with my deepest gratitude to the listeners, because without you, there would be no us. So that's the note on which I would like to end. And feel free if there's anything else that you want to say.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you. I mean, that means so much to me, that you're kind words. It's very, very gratifying to be able to help in that way and to know that I've even impacted one person to see the world differently. So that's really wonderful.
And you
wonderful.
Really did.
Thank you. Thank you. I do have one more thing to say.
No, I love it. Yeah, and I love that you feel comfortable saying, yes, let's do it. It's your show.
Well, it's related. You said TMC. So Tucson has this long history of being a healing destination. So back in the 1930s, people came here to heal from tuberculosis and arthritis.
Including Judy Collins.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
Not in the 30s.
Oh, no. But the TMC was built as a TB sanatorium. And the reason that that structure is so beautiful and so healing is all the rooms around those courtyards have access to the outdoors. It was part, and I describe this in my book, in Healing Spaces, it was part of a movement that was begun in Europe. And actually, Davos, Switzerland was very central in this, of the sun healing, the sun being important, essential for healing, sun and fresh air. And, there were sanatoria in the Adirondack Mountains. And
another beautiful place to spend time for this Jersey girl. My parents took us there every summer.
Well, those Adirondack chairs?
Yes.
You know how they slope back?
Yep.
That is the angle that's optimal for people with tuberculosis. It's not good to be lying flat. It's not, you're too weak to be standing. So those chairs were designed in part inspired by and I talk about this in the book, a European designer, Paimeo, who designed these chairs in a similar way in Europe. But it was a movement across Europe and North America that in order to heal from diseases like tuberculosis and arthritis, you need to be out in the sun and in the fresh air. And so those courtyards, which each one is wonderful at TMC, each one is designed in a different way. There was apparently a competition between the staff of the different wards so that they could each design the courtyards differently. Fortunately, more and more hospitals are incorporating these kinds of principles. Not all of them have the luxury
of being one level for
one level and having been built way back when. But more and more hospitals, and in fact, the new Banner University Medical Center has gorgeous views to the mountains, and the clinic has gorgeous views to the mountains. So these kinds of principles are being instantiated into healing environments of all sorts. I mentioned the residential communities for aging populations. There's, you know, communities across Tucson.
Diamond's Children's Center.
Diamond
for
Children's
Hospital.
Too, right.
Every age.
Every age. So, and I think the developers in Tucson are really leading the way in this domain. And so we are really very fortunate that in many ways Tucson has evolved and is a healing destination, not only in hospitals, not only in terms of these residential communities for aging, but also there are the spas, all the spas here,
right.
The hotels. People
right.
come from all over the world to heal in Tucson. So we should be incredibly proud of our wonderful city with these amazing views, and we're doing the cutting edge work to figure out how to create these healing environments for everyone in all aspects. University of Arizona, the College of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape Architecture, Mary Harden, takes students down to the barrios and builds housing for the underserved, low-income housing that incorporates all of these principles.
Elements.
All of these elements. So we are very fortunate that I think Tucson and the University of Arizona are definitely leading the way in this domain. There are no other universities where you have it all in the same place. The College of Medicine, the Center for Integrative Medicine, architecture, engineering, science, data science. We can do it here, and we're doing it here.
And the beat goes on.
Yes,
and
it's
to
wonderful.
Me, this time in history, it's even ever more important because of the ticking clock of climate change and how we can adapt and do the optimal for our survival, and not just survival, but the quality of the experience of life. So you get the last word, and thank you. I really, we couldn't end on a better note.
Thank you so much.